It was a fine, clear day, the sea like a mirror, Captain Omai would later write. Our confidence of success in the coming night battle was manifest in the cheerful atmosphere on the bridge. Shortly after 6 p.m., the Chokai and her consorts made their rendezvous with the 6th Cruiser Division, whom Mikawa had fallen column behind the flagship. The Yubari moved to the starboard bow of Chokai, and the Tenryu, followed by the Yunagi, moved to the port bow to screen against submarines. Not that they were especially effective. At 7:42 p.m., when the Japanese formation was some 8 miles west of Cape St. George, it literally ran over the old U.S. submarine S-38. Having detected the Japanese ships at around 7:25, the submerged submarine tried to move into an attack position, but she ended up square in their path. Apparently without realizing it, the Yubari and Tenryu bracketed the S-38 in between the two Japanese cruisers, Tenryu ahead and Yubari astern. 3 minutes later came the heavy cruisers, passing overhead, one so close that its wash caused the S-38 to roll 7 degrees. The nice, fat Japanese targets were too close for torpedoes to arm. As soon as the ships had finished passing, the S-38 turned to try to follow them, but they were moving at a very high speed, too fast for a submarine, and she lost track of them at around 8:10 p.m. She radioed a contact report to MacArthur's headquarters. Missing out on these large, valuable men of war was a disappointment to the S-38, but she would keep trying. During the night, Mikawa had his force loop around the northern coast of Bougainville, the northern plug, to the slot. He had to maintain a very careful balance. He needed more information on the makeup of the enemy force, so he wanted to be close enough at daybreak to be able to launch his floatplanes to reconnoiter the enemy dispositions off Guadalcanal and hopefully find those missing aircraft carriers, but not so close that his ships would attract the attention of said carriers or divulge his ultimate objective. Accordingly, at about 6:25 a.m., the Chokai, Aoba, Kako, and Kinugasa each launched a floatplane. The Furutaka would have joined them, but its plane developed engine trouble at the last minute. The Aoba's was to search the Guadalcanal area. The others headed east to try to find the elusive enemy carriers. With the scout planes launched, Admiral Mikawa had his ships disperse and change course periodically in order to launch the remaining float plans on anti-submarine patrols and deceive Allied scout planes as to his intentions. At 10:20 a.m., a Royal Australian Air Force Lockheed Hudson bomber was sighted circling high overhead. In an attempt to throw the Hudson off his intentions, Mikawa had his ships change course toward Rabaul. The Hudson remained over the cruisers for 16 minutes before heading back to its base at Milne Bay. The Chokai intercepted the contact report from the Hudson. 3 cruisers, 3 destroyers, and 2 seaplane tenders or gunboats, course 120 degrees true, speed 15. During this time, the Kako was informed, apparently by the Aoba's floatplane, that another Hudson was inbound. Mikawa was now convinced he was being tailed. The Chokai and Kinugasa recovered their floatplanes, which had found nothing, by 11 a.m., when that second Hudson finally appeared. Mikawa thought this was the same Hudson that had circled them earlier, while Admiral Matsuyama thought it was actually a B-25 Mitchell. All the same, the Hudson came in low from the northwest, trying to get a close look at the mysterious ships, but a few shots from the Chokai's forward main battery were impressive enough to drive it away. Mikawa was certain his position had been reported, and the enemy now knew where he was. He was half right. Though the Kako's floatplane, an Aichi E-13A1, had been shot down by Lieutenant Commander Snowden, at around noon the Aoba's floatplane returned and reported 1 battleship, 1 auxiliary carrier, 4 cruisers, 7 destroyers, and 15 transports off Lunga Point, Guadalcanal, and 2 heavy cruisers, 12 destroyers, and 3 transports off Tulagi. This was a troubling report for Admiral Mikawa. The biggest threat to his ships were the enemy carriers, and they were still nowhere to be found. Moreover, there were more enemy ships than the 5th Air Attack Force's report of damage inflicted during the previous day's air attacks had led him to believe there would be. But the 5th's damage assessment could not have been wrong, could it? Nevertheless, the report from the Aoba scout did give Admiral Mikawa some encouragement. The Allied naval power in the Guadalcanal area exceeded his own, true, and could overwhelm him if massed against him. However, it was divided between Guadalcanal and Tulagi, and Mikawa could overwhelm each group before the other could come to its aid. The admiral discussed the latest information, such as it was, with his staff over lunch. Though the enemy carriers still had not been found, if they were not within 100 miles or so of Guadalcanal, he would not have to worry about air attack until the next morning. That is, unless he got too close to the island in the afternoon, and thus exposed his force to air attack from the carriers. He expected the 5th Air Attack Force to attack the enemy around Guadalcanal and inflict serious losses, again, of which he would be informed in the late afternoon. So at 1 p.m., the admiral made the final decision to go forward with the mission. Mikawa reformed his scattered ships, ordered speed set at 24 knots, and headed for the Bougainville Strait and the New Georgia Sound. It wasn't exactly crossing the Rubicon, but the admiral felt no hesitation. The sea was dead calm, and visibility was, if anything, too good, Captain Omai would later say. Perfect weather, one might say, for bombing, which the Japanese feared was coming when, about 45 minutes after lunch, the lookouts in the Japanese force sighted aircraft approaching from the southeast. There were sighs of relief when they turned out to be Japanese bombers of the 5th Air Attack Force returning to Vunakanao. But the Mitsubishi G-4Ms were hardly an impressive sight, straggling in twos and threes. They must have been in a hell of a fight over Guadalcanal, chewed up, presumably, by U.S. carrier fighters. Admiral Mikawa went to the surprising length of breaking radio silence to ask the 5th Air Attack Force if they had any information on those carriers. He never received their negative reply. The admiral probably never appreciated the irony of their situation, indeed of his own situation. Not even 6 months earlier, it was the Allies who were slapping together a force of warships, who had never worked together, to desperately strike at enemy transports in the Java Sea. Now it was the Japanese. Then it had been the Allies sailing into waters they occupied but did not fully understand. Now it was the Japanese. Then it was the Allies who had left their base that was suffering from repeated air attacks, Surabaya, to go into a battle in which they never had a clear idea what they were facing. Now it was the Japanese. It had been the Allies who were in constant fear of daylight and feared the sight of even one enemy plane and what it could and almost always did portend. Now it was the Japanese. Admiral Mikawa was not one of the arrogant admirals whose insidious influence had largely caused the Japanese defeat at Midway, but he was still paying the price. How times had changed. How Midway had changed everything. At around 4 p.m., the scratch Japanese force passed through the Bougainville Strait, separating Bougainville Island from Choiseul to the southeast, and entered the New Georgia Sound, the slot. Battlefield commanders are always desperate for information, and Mikawa was no different. Still having heard nothing from the 5th Air Attack Force in Rabaul as to the results of their attacks, Admiral Mikawa ordered the Aoba to again launch her float plane to scout the Tulagi Guadalcanal area once more, passing between Choiseul and Vella La Vella first. He wanted information in his hands in time for the plane to return to the Aoba before sunset. If the aircraft could not return to the Aoba before sunset, it was to head to Shortland. Preparations for the coming attack began in earnest at 4:40 p.m., when Admiral Mikawa signaled his orders for the conduct of the battle. Except for the 4 heavy cruisers of the 6th Cruiser Division, none of these ships had worked together or maneuvered together before. The battle plan had to be kept simple. The force would operate in a column, that is, single file, Chokai followed by the 6th Cruiser Division, which in practice would be the Aoba, Kako, Kinugasa, and Furutaka. Then the Tenryu, Yubari, and Yunagi, arranged with the strongest ships in front and the weakest in back. We will penetrate south of Savo Island and torpedo the enemy main force at Guadalcanal. Then we will move toward the forward area at Tulagi and strike with torpedoes and gunfire, after which we will withdraw to the north of Savo Island. So it would be a counterclockwise sweep around Savo Island. Speed would be 24 knots. So the Japanese ships could recognize each other, long white sleeves were to be flown from the signal yards on each side of each ship's bridge. Mikawa's operations officer, Captain Omai, would later write, "While drafting this order, I had the firm conviction we would be successful." Admiral Goto was of the opinion that Mikawa's decision to attack at night and his direction of the operation offered an opportunity of great success. The confidence continued to build when at 4:54 p.m., the force turned to the southeast to make the dash to Guadalcanal through the slot, starting between Santa Isabel and New Georgia Islands, course 120 degrees true, speed 24 knots. Yet while the confidence built, the tension built as well, as about 20 minutes later they sighted a mast off the starboard bow. An unexpected enemy ship? No, the mast turned out to belong to the seaplane tender, a Kitsushima, now on her way to set up a seaplane base at nearby Gizo Island, after her errand of mercy trying to fish out the downed Val pilots the previous day. There were sighs of relief. They had not expected enemy ships. Not out here. Not yet. But they had expected enemy aircraft, more scout planes, carrier-based dive bombers, and torpedo planes. According to Captain Omai, the very existence of the enemy flat tops in the area was a major concern to Admiral Mikawa, and this dominated our later tactical concepts. And the Japanese radio operators had been picking up radio chatter from the American carrier planes, referring to their carriers with code names like Green Base and Red Base. Yet since those two Australian Hudsons that morning, the Japanese had seen no enemy planes. All afternoon, not one, not even a scout plane. Strange. Mikawa was not complaining, though, and as the sun dipped lower and lower in the sky, setting at 6:16, the possibility of an attack from the American carriers diminished, and the spirits and confidence of the officers and sailors continued to rise. That confidence would be further energized by Mikawa's inspirational speech, crafted by Captain Omai, to his men. The Chokai's Aldous Lamp flashed his message at 6:40 p.m. to each of the ships. In the finest tradition of the Imperial Navy, we shall engage the enemy in night battle. Every man is expected to do his best. With that, pursuant to Admiral Mikawa's order, each ship disposed of everything it had above the waterline that was flammable. It may seem like a little thing, but Mikawa was taking no chances. Fire has been the biggest dread of sailors since the beginning of sail. The replacement of flammable wood by steel in most ships had merely changed the dimension of that dread. Steel would not burn or melt easily, but it does not breathe, either, and a fire below decks could turn a ship's interior into a relative smoke-filled pressure cooker that would hamper firefighting efforts. Moreover, a fire could give away the ship's position to the enemy, a cloud of smoke visible over the horizon by day, a glowing beacon by night. So anything and everything that could burn, light oil, loose wood, paint, depth charges, munitions for the float planes, anything, was either stowed below decks or jettisoned over the side. The float planes themselves were fire risks as well, but the Admiral had special plans for them. At 9 p.m., while Admiral Mikawa and his staff were gathered in the flag plot preparing for battle, they finally received the report from the 5th Air Attack Force as to the damage caused by its attacks on the Allied ships off Guadalcanal. The flotilla claimed it had sunk two heavy cruisers, one large cruiser, two destroyers, and nine transports, and left two heavy cruisers and one transport burning. The report buoyed Mikawa's spirits and gave him more confidence in the coming clash. These Japanese airmen had just made his job easier by damaging the enemy so badly. The report was wrong, of course, badly wrong. It was around this time, one can argue that it was this very battle, that saw the start of the distinctively Japanese habit of reporting combat damage inflicted on the enemy that was inversely proportional to the damage actually inflicted. The Naval War College would later say the Japanese had a tendency, which became more pronounced throughout the war, to make exaggerated claims concerning enemy damage without first making every effort to verify the truth. Japanese claims seem almost to have been almost deliberately inversely related to reality, says naval historian H.P. Wilmot. What seems truly extraordinary about the Japanese situation is what seems to be the usually uncritical acceptance of the most preposterous of claims on the part of higher authority. Though Mikawa and his staff seem to have been on the verge of discounting the 5th Air Attack Force's battle damage assessments of the previous day, that apparently did not lead them to question the 5th's assessments on this day. Not that it would matter. for the Admiral was once again leaving as little as he could to chance and continuing what might be called battle space preparation. Between 11 and 11:13, the Chokai, Aoba, and Kako each launched a floatplane. The Imperial Japanese Navy had a peculiar preoccupation with seaplanes, both floatplanes and flying boats. The Navy was extremely aggressive with seaplanes, far more so than its American counterpart, and seemed to be of the opinion that there was no problem that could not be solved by adding more seaplanes. For now, however, in launching their floatplanes for a night battle, the Japanese were using a unique tactic that the Allies would never counter, let alone match. And on this night, it would be especially dangerous. The ships could not stop to lower the floatplanes into the sea for a water takeoff, so the aircraft had to be shot off the catapult. Not like a catapult on today's aircraft carriers, which act somewhat like a slingshot. A cruiser catapult was more like a cannon, with an explosive charge used to basically shoot the floatplane off the rail of a moving ship into the air at night. The air crews, 9 men led by First Lieutenant Kiyose Fumio, had never done this at night before, but remarkably, they were able to do so without incident. Yet the dangers did not end there. The mission of these 3 floatplanes on this night was threefold. First, they were to drop navigational markers in the form of float lights or flares that burned on the water to help guide the Japanese ships into the battle area. Second, they were to scout and report on the dispositions of the Allied ships. Third, they were to drop flares to illuminate and preferably backlight the enemy ships when the Japanese force was some 20 miles from the enemy. The problem here was that once the mission was complete, the floatplanes could not be recovered. Admiral Mikawa's cruisers would be speeding as fast as possible to get as far away from the as-yet-unsighted American aircraft carriers as they could, so they could not stop to pick up the floatplanes. They would have to somehow make their way back to the Japanese base in the Shortlands off Bougainville in the dark. In other words, for these 9 men, this was quite possibly a one-way mission to drop flares. What had been a sunny day had, the closer one got to Guadalcanal, devolved into a moonless, completely overcast night. It was hot, humid, sticky, and oppressive. Between the lack of a moon, the clouds now blanketing the area, blocking all starlight, and the absence of light from the Solomons, underdeveloped as they were, the darkness was beyond the extreme version often found at sea. It would swallow anything that sailed into it, or at least seemed to do so to the untrained eye. But the Japanese eyes on duty at night were not untrained. Quite the opposite, in fact. Part of the strategic emphasis of the Imperial Japanese Navy was on night fighting in order to, in their minds, even the odds against the United States that had its naval superiority written into law ever since the Washington Naval Treaty. Part of that night fighting ability was detecting the enemy before the enemy detected the Japanese. The Japanese had no radar at this time, so they depended on the eyes of the lookouts stationed on their ships. The lookouts were specifically chosen for their excellent eyesight. They were thoroughly trained in ship recognition and low-light conditions, and they had the excellent Japanese optics in the form of oversized binoculars with strong magnification and even polarized lenses to filter out haze. In practice, at least at this point in the Pacific War, Japanese nighttime eyes often outperformed American radar. As excellent and unparalleled as these lookouts were, Admiral Mikawa did not want to depend exclusively on them, which is why he had sent up his floatplanes to drop flares to make the lookouts' job easier. And the lookouts in the scratched Japanese force started spotting those flares. At 11:30 p.m., the Tenryu sighted a float light dropped by one of the floatplanes. This flare was dropped to burn on the water as a navigational aid to mark 30 miles from Cape Esperance on Guadalcanal on a bearing of 140 degrees true. It was hoped this float light would be far enough out to escape Allied detection. At midnight, the crews went to battle stations. The ships moved from their cruising formation into the battle formation as Admiral Mikawa had ordered, a single column, led by the flagship Chokai, followed by the Aoba, Kako, Kinugasa, Furutaka, Tenryu, Yubari, and Yunagi, in that order. Increasing speed to 28 knots, they would go in by the south entrance to the sound, that is, south of Savo Island. However, the closer they got to this tiny volcanic island, the visibility had, if anything, gotten worse, with squalls now popping up. Squalls had a habit of appearing around Tsavo Island, especially to its south and east, late at night. As the squalls drifted to the southeast, they would usually break up. But not tonight. Admiral Mikawa had the Chokai flash two last messages to his ships at 12:25 a.m. The first was relaying a report from one of his float planes. Three heavy cruisers south of Tsavo Island, course 290 degrees true, speed 18 knots. Now they had some idea of what to expect in this imminent battle south of Tsavo Island. Mikawa indeed had the local superiority he had wanted. He also signaled, "Prepare to fire torpedoes." Launching torpedoes was the preferred Japanese method for launching a nighttime attack. Torpedoes don't reveal positions in the dark and have a much longer range than guns. At least the Japanese Type 93 torpedo did. At 12:30, the float planes reported about 20 transports in the anchorage and three or four cruisers at the eastern end of the channel. The odd and encouraging part of the report was that the transports were using their lights to illuminate the offloading of cargo. They would not be using their lights if they were expecting combat. Somehow Admiral Mikawa's surprise had been preserved. Soon the lookouts were seeing a different kind of flares in the dark, actual fires, in the direction of Tulagi, and they saw a reflection of fire in the clouds overhead, one that didn't quite fit the fires they were seeing. Tiny, volcanic Tsavo Island finally came into view at 12:40 a.m. The tension went up yet another notch. "Ship approaching, 30 degrees starboard." The loud call came from a lookout on the Chokai at 12:43 a.m. The Aoba, directly astern of the flagship, spotted the unknown vessel a minute later. The ship was on a bearing of 162 degrees true, 10,900 yards away. In other words, the Japanese lookouts had spotted a ship over 5 miles away on an overcast night with intermittent squalls and no moon. The training of the lookouts was paying off. Their work here was nothing short of incredible. On the flagship bridge, all breathing seemed to stop, while we waited identification of his sighting, Captain Omai would later write. They were in territory where no Japanese ships were known to be operating, but where enemy ships were known to be present in large numbers. It was really only a question of what type of ship it was. It was, as the Naval War College put it, a ship resembling a destroyer. And it was on a northeasterly course to cross the path of Admiral Mikawa's ships. Almost a collision course, even. The Admiral was caught somewhat off guard. His scouts had not indicated an enemy destroyer this far out. But here it was. After all this, this whirlwind of events, it all came down to this one destroyer. Admiral Mikawa stood on the bridge watching the destroyer's movements with a mixture of trepidation and no small measure of amazement. The enemy ship was about to cross his path, almost collide with his ship. Hadn't it seen him? "Stand by for action," radioed the Chokai. The action would come from the Japanese only in the Admiral's order to open fire. Every gun was trained on the lone destroyer. The Tenryu had even started pulling out of the column to head toward her. Would he give the order? The Admiral was decisive. "Left rudder, slow to 22 knots. Blow the surprise for a mere destroyer? Admiral Mikawa thought not. He turned away from the destroyer, course 100 degrees true, signaled enter by the north entrance, and slowed down, hoping to reduce the wakes of his ships. For not only were they kicking up a lot of water, as ships tend to do, the wakes they were leaving were almost glowing, a luminescence caused by disturbing the Noctiluca scintillans, a microorganism indigenous to South Pacific waters. The bioluminescence earned the species the nickname Sea Sparkle. The Admiral did not want anything sparkling about his ships this night. If the destroyer gave any indication of seeing them, the guns of the Japanese cruisers, now trained on her, would open fire. So many guns firing at one little destroyer at a range that kept decreasing would not end well for the destroyer. There was complete silence on the Chokai's bridge. The lone destroyer got closer and closer. The range was now down to less than a mile. The Japanese could look down on her, even see crewmen walking around on her deck. Captain Omai, like most of the Japanese watching, was fascinated by the encounter. From her deliberate, unconcerned progress, it was plain she was unaware of us, or of being watched, and of the fact that every gun in our force was trained directly on her. Seconds strained while we waited for the inevitable moment when she must sight us. And then the enemy destroyer reversed course. She reversed course and sailed away. With no change in speed, she made a starboard turn and proceeded in the direction from which she had come, totally unaware of our approach, according to Captain Omai. The Japanese lookouts were shocked. Admiral Mikawa was incredulous. How could the enemy miss us? But miss them she did. The destroyer, the USS Blue, went back to her assigned patrol course, heading back toward the southwest, blind as a sleepwalker, according to one historian. "Ship sighted 20 degrees port," came the call from the Chokai's lookouts, almost simultaneous with the Blue's turnabout. It was another destroyer? That's what the Japanese believed. It was the Ralph Talbot. The ship was steaming away from them, too. "Right rudder, steer course 150 degrees, said Admiral Mikawa. The Chokai signaled enter from South Passage. The Blue and Ralph Talbot had not coordinated their patrol routes, so both were heading away from the slot, the main and most obvious avenue for a Japanese approach from Mobile to Guadalcanal, at the same time. There was a gap some 9 miles wide. Not very wide by naval standards, but enough. At 26 knots, the deadly Japanese squadron steamed coolly, quietly, and confidently between the two destroyers whose job was to warn of approaching enemy ships. These destroyers were not the ships they were looking for. There was far bigger game ahead. Just how and why the Ralph Talbot, and especially the Blue, missed the approach of the Japanese has never been conclusively determined. The two destroyers employed two methods for detection of enemy ships, radar and lookouts. On this night, both failed. Radar was still a relatively new invention at this time. When people think of radar today, they think of what they see on television when a storm is coming. The meteorologist refers to a map showing the storms, with a line originating at the center of the map that rotates, the line representing the sweep of the radar, and the origination point, the radar antenna. The sweep of the line refreshes the echo of the storms, so as a storm moves, the radar can track that movement. This type of display is called a planned position indicator, PPI, and is the most common type of radar display in use today. While the electronics and physical principles involved can be complicated, the display is relatively easy to understand. That is not what the Blue or Ralph Talbot had. The type of radar the destroyers had was called SC radar. It was a search radar used for detection of ships and aircraft, but it was in detecting the latter that it was far more effective. The display for this SC radar is called an A-scope, which looks less like the PPI with its top-down view than an EKG. The scope shows a line across the screen, usually with tiny lines emanating from it, caused by the interference of the receiver itself, and by their appearance earned the nickname grass. Radar returns were represented by vertical lines emanating from this line. Without going into detail, the vertical line on an SC radar display would indicate that something was out there, and how far out there that something was, but only that. That vertical line could represent a plane or a ship or an island. With so many islands in the Solomons, it would be easy for inexperienced radar operators to mistake the line actually representing a ship as being from an island. Or the line from the ship could be lost in the bigger line from a nearby island. It was for this reason that the SC radar was better at detecting incoming aircraft than it was incoming ships. Indeed, the Blues radar had earlier that night detected the unknown aircraft reported by the Ralph Talbot. But on this night, when surface ships were about, as the Naval War College put it, suffice it to say that the Blues radar was highly ineffective. More troubling, in many respects, is the failure of the Blues lookouts. Naval historian Samuel Elliott Morrison said the main problem with the lookouts was that they were looking in every direction but astern, a common enough issue. It appears, however, that the lookouts on the Blue were not looking in every direction but astern. Rather, they were all focused on Cape Esperance, on Guadalcanal, trying to make sure the navigation was correct so the Blue could maintain the course that gave her the best chance of spotting incoming attackers. How all the lookouts watching Cape Esperance, and none looking at the single most obvious avenue of Japanese approach, the slot, gave the Blue the best chance of spotting incoming attackers, has never been explained. Naval historians Bruce Loxton, who served in the Canberra, and Chris Coulthard Clark, in their extensive analysis of the engagement, probably put it best. No one on watch in Blue saw, at a range of about a mile, a column of eight ships, five of which were about 10,000 tons, moving across the line of sight at high speed, and this on a night when Chokai's lookouts could see a single destroyer proceeding at 12 knots at 8 miles. Blue's failure to see the Japanese is inexplicable and inexcusable. Inexplicable is also the description used by Australian Rear Admiral Galfrey George Ormond Gattaker, then a commander serving as Admiral Crutchley's operations officer, who acidly added, "The Japanese had sighted our destroyers at long range, but to pass a few hundred yards from one of them without being seen cannot be credited to Japanese night battle practice and night lookout training. They needed to collide with Blue that night to make their presence known." In fairness to the lookouts on the Blue, one must call attention to the words of Captain Stephen Roskill, naval historian and skipper of the Royal New Zealand Navy's light cruiser Leander, which would have its own odd role of sorts in the events of this night, which would take part in the fighting in the Solomons in 1943. The reader who feels strongly about the unreadiness of the ships, the failure of communications, and the poor lookout maintained, should himself experience the strain of trying to remain alert for several consecutive nights after long and anxious days in the deadening and exhausting heat of the Solomon Islands climate. It is a fair point, and one that should always be kept in mind here. But war is not fair, and cares little for intentions. The Japanese had a history of not being fair in war, especially the current one, and Admiral Mikawa, honorable officer though he may have been, had no intention of being so tonight. So as they passed through the 9-mile gap, Admiral Mikawa, not quite believing what was happening, turned to the Chokai skipper, Captain Hayakawa Mikio, and shrugged, "The Americans must be asleep." In ancient Rome, when a legion set up camp for the night, a small group of soldiers would have the duty of providing a night watch for the camp. Tired after a hard day of martial duties, these unfortunate legionaries still had to stay awake and keep their eyes open for the approach of an enemy army or spy. The punishment for falling asleep on night watch duty was death. The Allies were about to find out why. Imagine driving a semi-tractor-trailer rig to meet a friend in a darkened parking lot full of semi-tractor-trailer rigs with their lights off. This was Admiral Crutchley in the Australia trying to find Admiral Turner in the Macaulay. He had been maneuvering for almost 2 hours, hoping to find the Macaulay without running into any of the thin-skinned transports in the dark. As a result, Crutchley did not arrive on the Macaulay until about 10:30 p.m. Because General Vandegrift had not yet arrived, Turner and Crutchley discussed the very delayed report from the Hudson that morning of 3 cruisers, 3 destroyers, and 2 seaplane tenders or gunboats, delayed by, as it turned out, simple lethargy among Allied communications personnel, still getting used to the concept of messages being time-sensitive. Both agreed that the force could arrive off Guadalcanal that night, but those seaplane tenders also suggested that the Japanese would set up a seaplane base, probably near Rakata Bay, and attack with seaplanes the next morning. The idea that the report may have been wrong in identifying the ship types doesn't seem to have occurred to anyone. Besides, there had been no report from the search Turner had ordered to cover the slot that morning. It must not have found anything, Turner thought, or more accurately, assumed. Turner had no way of knowing the supplemental search had, for reasons that have never been fully established, never been carried out. General Vandegrift finally arrived around 11:15 p.m. As exhausted as he was by his duties on Guadalcanal, he thought the admirals looked ready to pass out. But Admiral Turner made sure everyone had ample supplies of coffee, and the meeting got underway. Turner showed General Vandegrift Admiral Fletcher's message about withdrawing the carriers. The Marine General snarled that Fletcher was running away 12 hours earlier than he had already threatened. He was preaching to the choir, but Turner felt his hands were tied. It was known that Japanese air reinforcements were headed into the Rabaul Air Complex. The report of those seaplane tenders suggested an air attack coming in the morning, and now their air cover was being pulled. The only option was to withdraw the transports. Unfortunately, Admiral Turner had badly underestimated the time it would take to unload the transports. Everyone had. Turner asked Vandergrift about maximizing the little time they had left to unload the most badly needed supplies on Guadalcanal. The general noted that the 1st Marine Division would face shortages of food, ammunition, and other essentials. Nevertheless, he said, we are in fair shape on Guadalcanal. On Tulagi, however, the combat had delayed offloading, and Vandergrift wanted to check its status. Professorially, peering over his glasses, Turner replied, I thought you would want that. I have a minesweeper standing by to take you over there. Admiral Crutchley offered to have his launch drop the general off at the minesweeper on his way back to the Australia. Vandergrift declined, but Crutchley insisted, your mission is much more important than mine. They boarded Admiral Crutchley's launch at around midnight, then struggled through a torrential downpour until they could find the minesweeper. As the general departed, the admiral shook his hand. Frustrated with the entire situation, caught in the middle, the veteran Crutchley empathized with the plight of the Marines and how much they needed the Navy right now, but closed with a word of understanding for his superior. I don't know that I can blame Turner for what he's doing. It was 1:30 a.m. when Crutchley returned to the Australia. By his calculations, any Japanese surface attack would have to take place by 2 a.m. in order to get back within the range of air cover from Rabaul before U.S. carrier planes could strike. It was only theoretical, inasmuch as Admiral Fletcher was having the U.S. carriers bravely run away, but the Japanese did not know that. It would be nearly 3 a.m. before the Australia could rejoin the Chicago and the Canberra in the southern group. The flagship would have to maneuver to take the head of the column in restricted waters without radar or voice radio, with visibility reduced by the night's rainstorms and the lack of a moon. Or he could avoid all those risks and keep the Australia with the transports protected by the anti-submarine screen until dawn, when he could rejoin the southern force. The admiral chose the latter option. After all, that 2 a.m. was only a half hour away, and there was no indication the Japanese were coming tonight. In a silent, ghostly procession, the Chokai led a gaggle of warships into the swallowing darkness west of Savo Island, unseen, unexpected. Starting at 1:12 a.m., Admiral Mikawa had the Japanese column loop to the south of Savo, coming within some 1,200 yards of the shore. He continued the loop until 1:24 a.m., when the Chokai extended the loop further to the southeast, to avoid a large mass of clouds and rain that covered the southern part of the island and extended several miles to the south. If Mikawa had been hoping the island and the clouds would help camouflage his ships, he was to be rewarded far more than he had any reason to expect. At around this time, the Japanese finally saw the cause of the mysterious orange glow reflected off the clouds, the American transport George F. Elliott still burning. Helping the Japanese by acting as a beacon to the anchorage, illuminating the Allied ships, and fouling the night vision of the already tired Allied lookouts. The float plane pilots were now chomping at the bit to begin dropping their flares, but Mikawa, not quite ready, told them to hold off. At 1:26, the admiral signaled to his ships, "Proceed independently." In theory, this meant that the Chokai, the 6th Cruiser Division, the 18th Cruiser Division, and the Yonagi would each determine its own targets. 6 minutes later, Mikawa had the column turned to port to course 95 degrees true for the dash into the Allied anchorage off Guadalcanal. He signaled, "All ships attack! Cruiser, 7 degrees to port!" As close as Mikawa had gotten to Savo Island, somehow this ship had managed to get even closer, in between the island and the Japanese. Some 3,000 yards away from Chokai, it was moving very slowly to the west. The lookouts thought it was an Achilles-class light cruiser, the HMNZS Leander, maybe? Captain Omai thought it too small for a cruiser, so it must be a destroyer. Which, in fact, it was. The USS Jarvis, crawling across this battlefield to be, the exact reason for her presence a mystery to everyone, including her, that will never be solved. She wasn't supposed to be there, with her radio suite out. Admiral Turner had given an order for her executive officer to carry to her skipper, Lieutenant Commander Graham, to head for Afati via the Eastern Channel, but to wait for the destroyer minesweeper Hovey to escort her before doing so. The order was also flashed to her by an Aldous lamp. but she never acknowledged the order. She may have never received it. Exactly why, a mystery. She also did not follow standard protocol in requesting permission to leave. So it seems that without telling anyone, around midnight, the Jarvis started towards Sydney, Australia, where the destroyer tender Dobbin could help with her repairs by creeping through the Western Channel, taking the same route she had taken to get to Guadalcanal in the first place, and blundering into the Japanese intruders. To Mikawa, the Jarvis appeared to be in a good position to launch torpedoes, but with a combination of incredible nerve and even more incredible luck, he held fire as the destroyer moved like some black phantom in the opposite direction along the entire 5-mile-long Japanese column, at one point coming within 1,100 yards of the Tenryu. The Jarvis gave no indication of having seen them and had no crew visible on her deck. Both whether she saw them and what she could have done if she had are open to question. She was suffering severe structural issues with a large torpedo hole in her side that limited her speed to 7 knots or so. Her radio was out, and she had jettisoned her torpedoes and other topside non-essentials to save on weight and thus improve her battered buoyancy, which left many of her weapons offline. And she was alongside an enemy column of 7 cruisers and a destroyer. 3 cruisers, 9 degrees to starboard, moving to the right. The call came from the Chokai's lookouts at 1:36 a.m., the range about 12,500 yards on a bearing of 120 degrees true. They were the Canberra and Chicago, with the destroyers Patterson and Bagley screening, almost at the western end of their patrol line. Admiral Mikawa ordered a course change toward them. A minute later, another group of cruisers was sighted to the north, bearing 300 degrees, range 18,000 yards. So the Allies were indeed divided into 2 groups, and Admiral Mikawa had superiority over each of them. He needed to eliminate each quickly before they could combine, and he had the element of surprise, just as he had hoped. The Canberra and Chicago were headed almost directly toward the Japanese ships, presenting a narrow bow profile that would be difficult for torpedoes to hit, unless the Allied cruisers changed course. Captain Hayakawa boomed the order, "Torpedoes, fire to starboard! Fire!" It would take the torpedoes 6 minutes to reach their targets. Overhead, Lieutenant Kiyose was finally given permission to begin dropping the flares. On a night when every American and Australian around Guadalcanal and Tulagi desperately wanted even a little rest and relaxation, the skipper of the U.S. destroyer Patterson, Commander Frank Walker, allowed no such thing. He had seen the Hudson's sighting report of 3 cruisers, 3 destroyers, and 2 seaplane tenders or gunboats, and had calculated that whatever Japanese force this described could arrive off Tsavo tonight. What if the Hudson's description of the ships was wrong? What if those ships were all cruisers? Walker stayed on the bridge and kept his torpedo tubes loaded and ready for firing. Supposedly, Commander Walker was not the only one expecting a battle that night. According to Jack Coombe, everyone had been expecting an attack that night because of reports of heavy Japanese ship movements at Rabaul, but no one knew the direction from which it would come. Most concluded it would come from the north, which offered the best approach with possible reinforcements from truck. But expecting and prepared are not the same. Commander Walker and his crew were prepared. On the Patterson's starboard quarter, Captain Getting of the Canberra, like Commander Walker, had concluded with his staff that the Japanese ships reported by the Hudson could reach Tsavo that night. Unlike Walker, however, Getting had taken the report at face value and assumed it was correct. Those 2 seaplane tenders meant he could expect another air attack in the morning. He had better get some long overdue sleep, which he was getting in a chair in his sea cabin when he was summoned to the bridge, 1 deck above. At 1:43 a.m., the senior officer on watch, Lieutenant Commander E.J. White, had detected an explosion off the starboard bow, almost due north. Almost immediately thereafter, the port lookout had reported a ship dead ahead, but against the dark, amorphous mass of the squall south of Tsavo, no one else could see it, except for a lookout on the Patterson. He saw a strange black shape almost dead ahead, distance about 5,000 yards. Commander Walker immediately ordered battle stations and, speeding up to 20 knots, ordered a hard port turn to unmask the starboard torpedo tubes for a launch at the unidentified shape, actually the Furutaka, fifth in the Japanese column. Critically, he ordered a message to be broadcast by radio and by Aldous Lamp, warning, warning, strange ships entering harbor. As the Patterson swung to port, her guns opened up on the Furutaka, and she quickly reached a favorable torpedo launch position. But the torpedo officer apparently could not hear Commander Walker's order to launch torpedoes over the roar of the guns, and the destroyer's torpedoes never left their tubes. Not so the Furutaka. She launched one torpedo from her four starboard tubes at the Patterson. The destroyer did not even see the torpedo until it had sped by harmlessly. Curiously, the Patterson could not see her companion destroyer Bagley, but she did see two more Japanese cruisers, Tenryu and Yubari, enter the fray. She broadcast a second warning by voice radio, "All ships, warning, warning, three enemy ships inside Savo Island." Now, over the defenseless anchored transports near Lunga Point, Lieutenant Kiyoshi's flares started to appear, five of them, attached to tiny parachutes, about a mile between each. Intense light providing brilliant illumination and perfectly backlighting the Canberra and Chicago. On the former, while Captain Gadding was on his way to the bridge, Lieutenant Commander White spotted wakes from three ships off the starboard bow, then saw the Patterson flash her warning message. The cruiser went to battle stations. White shouted, "Alarm starboard! Load, load, load!" for the 8-inch guns, and ordered a port turn to unmask the rear turrets and thus allow all the guns to fire at the intruders. But the skipper had other ideas. Captain Gedding arrived to see torpedoes passing down each side of the ship. They were from the Chokai. The premature explosion of the fourth had been seen from the bridge. With her target now nicely silhouetted, the Chokai opened fire with her 8-inch main armament, the other Japanese cruisers following the lead of the flagship. Gedding ordered, "Hard to starboard," and "Full ahead." He was more concerned about keeping a blocking position between the Japanese and the transports he was supposed to be protecting. The Canberra began picking up speed in her turn to starboard, toward her own screening destroyer Bagley. In theory, anyway. Curiously, no one could see the Bagley. While switching to a combat footing was happening smoothly, if not totally effectively, on the Patterson and Canberra, it seems that something was happening on the Bagley, but precisely what was never recorded. What is known for certain is that upon sighting the Japanese, the Bagley increased speed to 25 knots and made a sharp turn to port toward the Canberra, apparently passing her to starboard. The turn was ostensibly to unmask the starboard torpedo tubes for firing at the approaching enemy, but the starboard tubes were not fired at this time for reasons that remain disputed. The Bagley's skipper, Lieutenant Commander George A. Sinclair, said there was no time to insert the firing primers that ignited the explosive charges that launched the torpedoes. But torpedo man Third Class Eugene McClarty would later say the primers were always in place whenever the destroyer was at sea. Rather, he said that the Bagley was turning too fast to be able to aim the tubes properly. Mistakes in handling a ship at the beginning of combat are hardly unusual. The Canberra had already made one this night, but the curiosities do not end there. Lieutenant Commander Sinclair, apparently a highly nervous man, was an engineer by training, inexperienced at ship handling, and was at best uncomfortable doing so. In a command arrangement that might most politely be described as unusual, it was normal on the Bagley for Sinclair to hand over control of the destroyer to his executive officer, Lieutenant Commander Thomas E. Chambers, in awkward situations. Presumably combat would qualify as just that. Afterwards, there was talk on the Bagley that Sinclair had panicked and thrown the destroyer into the hard port turn away from the Japanese column. At some point, Lieutenant Commander Chambers took command, possibly forcibly, from Sinclair. The Bagley's sharp port turn was steadied on a northeasterly course, and the port torpedo tubes were brought to bear on the Japanese. The situation was critical, as the Bagley's lookouts could see the Japanese salvos starting to find the range on the Canberra. At 1:49, the No. 2 torpedo mount launched four torpedoes toward the northwest at what she identified as two Tenryu-class light cruisers and two Ashigara-class heavy cruisers. But while the torpedoes were launching, the Japanese ship seemed to disappear. The black background of Savo Island and the ephemeral murk of the squall were posing difficulties for the Allied lookouts. The sound gear reported an explosion at the time their torpedoes should have hit their targets. The Bagley couldn't see what her torpedoes had hit, but the explosion was in the enemy area, as Lieutenant Commander Sinclair put it, so it had to be something Japanese, right? Like a well-oiled machine, the Canberra was swinging into action both figuratively and literally. Captain Getting ordered a report of the sighting of the three cruisers to be signaled to Chicago. Her four turrets were manned, loaded, and ready, as were her torpedo tubes. She continued her starboard turn, essential for blocking the route to the transports, but also throwing off the firing solutions for her own guns and torpedo tubes. She was still silhouetted by the flares and the burning George F. Elliott, and the Japanese guns were starting to find the range, but now the Japanese cruisers were themselves coming into the light provided by those flares. And their column was beginning to fray. The Chokai, still firing at the Canberra, had begun to turn to the northeast, which would take her toward the transports in the Tulagi area, and also allow all five of her turrets to bear on the Allied ships. The Furutaka had pulled out of the column to starboard for some reason, possibly to unmask her four port torpedo tubes, possibly because of steering issues that cropped up at about this time. She was now off the starboard quarter of the 6th Cruiser Division. She thus had a clear view of the Canberra about 9,000 yards away, so she immediately followed the Chokai's 8-inch salvos with several of her own, as well as four torpedoes, which missed. The Aoba, second in the Japanese column, was now leading two cruisers of the 6th Cruiser Division right at the Canberra and opened gunfire at a range of 4,200 yards. The Australian lookout spotted the Aoba's torpedoes approaching from the port side. They, too, missed. The Kako, third in the Japanese column, unloaded on the Australian cruiser at a range of 4,000 yards with 8-inch and 4.7-inch gunfire and four torpedoes. The Japanese salvos were creeping up to the Australian cruiser, but a few more seconds and her gun director would have a firing solution on the Japanese and those 8-inch guns could train to port and fire. At about 1:48, the Canberra was rocked by two explosions as Japanese 8-inch shells finally found their mark. Both hit the area of the port side of the bridge. One wrecked the plotting room, killed the gunnery officer, and mortally wounded Captain Getting. Fire started spreading amidships. Some crew members saw and felt a sickening thud just before a third explosion that sent a large column of water over the ship, oddly from the starboard side, the side away from the Japanese. The Canberra immediately lost all power, no engines, no guns, no torpedoes, no pumps, took a 5-degree list to starboard, and had amidships fire that made a fine point of aim in the darkness. She could not move, she could not fight, she was utterly helpless. Her 8-inch guns had fired exactly one shell, her 4-inch guns no more than a few. A sailor had run to the radio room to send out the warning message, only to find the transmitter was smashed. In the next few minutes, the Canberra was hit no less than 24 times, including hits on A and X turrets, the 4-inch gun deck, the torpedo space, the aftergun director, and both engine rooms. Fred Tuccito of the Chicago was watching the carnage. "I can still see them shooting at the Canberra," he lamented. "One event I can't get rid of is seeing the Canberra take hit after hit. How could anyone live through such an ordeal?" While the Canberra was taking a pounding, Captain Bode's earlier decision to lead from behind was coming home to roost. Bode had been in a deep sleep in his emergency cabin near the bridge when things started happening. The lookouts reported two small flashes low on the water in the direction of Savo Island. Then flares started appearing astern, flares that were immediately identified as the type used by cruiser floatplanes for illumination purposes. The senior officer on watch, Lieutenant Commander George Holly, then watched the Canberra ahead of him make an unplanned turn to starboard, revealing two rather vague, dark objects between the Australian cruiser and the Patterson to port and a third to the right. They were the Kako, Kinugasa, and Aoba, respectively. At this point, Holly ordered battle stations. The clanging sounds of general quarters brought King Bode, the officer in tactical command of the Southern Force, out of his slumber and back to the bridge, where he, in the words of Samuel Elliott Morrison, acted as if dazed. Bode ordered both banks of 5-inch secondary guns to fire star shells, but before they could do so, the lookout started reporting torpedoes approaching from a dizzying number of angles. First, the starboard bridge lookout reported a torpedo wake from the Chokai to starboard. The bridge crew could not see it, but nevertheless Bode ordered Wright full rudder to try to parallel the wake. The words were hardly out of his mouth when the main battery control officer reported 2 torpedo wakes coming from slightly to port, so Bode ordered left full rudder to comb the wakes, or comb the torpedoes. That is, go to a course parallel to that of the torpedoes, presenting either a bow or stern profile that is narrow and thus minimize the chances of a torpedo hit. Both torpedoes crossed in front of the bow, one 70 yards away, the other a mere 20 yards. At about 1:47 a.m., main battery control reported yet another torpedo approaching the port bow. There was a thunderous explosion near the bow, shaking the entire ship and sending up a column of water as high as the foremast to ultimately drench the forward half of the ship. "It was like a kitchen full of pots and pans," said Ken Mazenhalder, manning one of the Chicago's starboard 5-inch guns. This tin fish had bitten off a chunk of the Chicago's bow below the waterline. "I knew we were hit," said Art King, manning one of the searchlights, "and I knew that we were going too fast. When word got up here that the bow had been blown off, I figured somebody's got to get word to the captain to slow down, otherwise those forward bulkheads were going to collapse one by one." Someone did. The Chicago slowed to 12 knots. Not unreasonably, Captain Bode thought the explosion came courtesy of the torpedo seen off the port bow. In fact, it came from the starboard side, launched by the Kako as part of a spread targeting what appeared to be a battleship. The Chicago resembled a modernized Pennsylvania or Nevada-class battleship, in miniature anyway. A second torpedo of that spread struck near the engineering spaces. It did not detonate, common for U.S. torpedoes, but rare for the Type 93, though it did leave an unsightly dent. With the cruiser's port turn having accomplished its objective, to a degree, Captain Bode kept the Chicago turning to port because the bridge crew and the lookouts could see heading for them some 4,000 yards away what was then believed to be a destroyer in a position to discharge torpedoes. The destroyer was actually the Furutaka, who had already launched the torpedoes that had missed the Chicago to port, but Bode never quite figured that out. It was hardly unusual this night. King Bode's strict disciplinarianism was reaping its fruits in what was now revealed to be his tenuous control of the Chicago. There was mass confusion on the bridge, as nobody had any idea what was happening, came a rather damning indictment from Doc Wallace, a member of the bridge crew. Wallace was manning one of the phone circuits and overheard Bode arguing with his gunnery officer over who was to control the radar. According to Bode's report, at about this time, 1:47 a.m., the Chicago's lookouts saw gunfire ahead, both off the starboard bow and some 40 degrees off the port bow. The Naval War College found it singular that this was the first gunfire reported by the Chicago when the Canberra, only 600 yards away, had been taking a pummeling from the Japanese for at least the preceding 3 minutes. Perhaps he missed it when he was arguing with his gunnery officer about the radar. No matter. Soldiers have been trained ahead of the sound of the gunfire when they do not know what is going on and have no overriding orders. Bode was not a soldier, and he could see, not hear, the gunfire, but the difference was immaterial. He headed toward this newly detected gunfire, away from the transports he was supposed to be protecting, but toward the gunfire. The gunfire off the Chicago's starboard bow was from what were thought to be 2 destroyers. There were actually Japanese light cruisers Tenryu and Yubari, who were exchanging fire with U.S. destroyer Patterson, the source of the gunfire off the Chicago's port bow. As tactical officer in command of the Southern Force, Captain Bode also had authority over the Patterson. But he issued no orders to the destroyer, gave her no guidance, indeed did not contact her at all. This was why the force clearly needed a flag officer to command it and not a skipper. So the Chicago groped her way along as if dazed, heading west. The bridge crew had seen the Furutaka in an attack position, yet somehow the main battery director could not get a fix on a target for her 8-inch guns to start shooting, and the Furutaka had subsequently sped off out of range. The bridge crew could see the battle between the Patterson and the 18th Cruiser Division, yet somehow the main battery director still could not get a fix on a target for her 8-inch guns. Captain Bode was responsible for the destroyer Patterson, yet he watched